Welcome to The Buzz with ACT IAC, your source for the hot topics and top issues affecting the federal technology market. Join us each week to hear insights from government and industry experts, stay informed on the challenges facing the public sector, and gain access to valuable reports and thought leadership. Enjoy. Hi, listeners. This is Colin Larson, producer for The Buzz with ACT IAC. Let's say you're a major American city with a sizable Air Force base, and the U.S. government decides to close that base. Obviously, the loss of a significant military installation can negatively impact your city's economy, but it can also present an opportunity. So how does a city adapt to this change? How do they redevelop the land, infrastructure, and resources from that closed base into something new? Well, these are the questions that the city of San Antonio confronted when Kelly Air Force Base was selected to be closed in 1995. What emerged in the aftermath of this closure was Port San Antonio, a technology and innovation campus that is fueling economic growth for the city. The Buzz is excited to present the first in a series of episodes exploring some of the many facets of Port San Antonio. This week, I'm joined by President and CEO Jim Pershbach to give us an introduction to the port. Jim, thanks so much for joining me.
Well, thanks for having me, Colin. Thrilled to be here.
To get started, why don't you give us a little bit of a history lesson? How did Kelly Air Force Base become Port San Antonio?
Well, that's a great story. You got to forgive me because I got a great passion over all things airplanes. So I'll start with the short version, but it's still a little bit long. Back in the early days of aviation, the first military flight took place here in San Antonio way back in 1910. We were looking to build an Army installation that could actually work for these newfangled airplanes. And one of the things I love about it, we've got in our break room a picture of them building this base, and you've got airplanes there, but the airport is being built by folks in horse-drawn wagons. It's 1917. And throughout the history of Kelly Air Force Base, if you look at it with an eye toward history, you look at it with an eye toward aviation, you really see a development that mirrored the development in aviation. We started working on airplanes when they were canvas and wood. Engines were reciprocating engines, and they became radial engines and then turbine engines. There was a massive runway that was here already, relatively speaking, but it was too small for the B-36. So as the B-36 started to come into the inventory, they started building a huge runway and a huge million square foot hangar, only to see the B-36 go out of the inventory before it ever even flew down here to San Antonio. And that's what we were left with. In 1995, when the decision was made to go from 5 air logistics centers just to 3, the conventional wisdom was, we probably should close down Kelly. We're going to concentrate in Georgia, in Oklahoma, and in Utah, but we really can't afford to lose that infrastructure. We really can't afford to lose that workforce. So the first step in our evolution was to work with the government to come up with what they called a privatize in place agreement. And this became Jim's words, horrible, horrible word if there's actually a lawyer on the line listening to me, a private air logistics center. The Boeing company, McDonnell Douglas, came down, Lockheed Martin, Standard Aero, a few other folks, and did what you traditionally do in maintaining military aircraft here in a private setting. But over the years, what we've realized is there are some tremendous opportunities to incorporate new technologies, digital technologies, automation, predictive analytics, critical infrastructure into these technologies. And over the past couple of years, that has been our focus. We're never going to turn our back on aviation, not when you got an old airplane guy here in the operation. But we've got about 14,000 people working on this campus today. We've added a little over 4,000 jobs just in the past 3 years because our focus has been, how do we incubate and encourage opportunities, whether it's educational and workforce development opportunities into these career sectors, or how do we find new and emerging technologies and match them into these big industries that we have on our campus?
So you mentioned the transition at Port San Antonio away from the historical industry of aerospace into these new technologies. How did Port San Antonio facilitate that transition? How do they draw these new industries to the area?
It's been a trial and error process. So early on, we did what every redevelopment of a closed Air Force installation or Army installation or Navy installation does. You go out and you try and offer incentives and you do economic development marketing and you try and bring in anybody that you can bring in. As we went through the process, we realized that we had a few differentiators that not a lot of folks in the country had, not a lot of folks in the world have. San Antonio was blessed by having some very, very deep silos in some really important technologies. With aviation and aerospace, we've been doing that since 1910 here in San Antonio. With what is now called cybersecurity and information and warfare, that came to this campus in 1948, 1953, with signals intelligence, what is now the 16th Air Force. We've got Southwest Research Institute just up the street from us, who build and maintain more satellites than most countries. In fact, the New Horizons Explorer and the Interstellar Boundary Explorer are both Southwest Research projects. And a lot of work going on with medicine, particularly in military medicine. So the strategy started to morph over the years into, instead of just trying to bring in businesses for business's sake, let's try and fill in those gaps. Let's try and find companies, innovative solutions, talent development that takes these massive industrial and massive government sector buyers that we have and provide them with an opportunity to move forward and be successful. And it's been something that I think was surprising to a lot of folks, probably even surprising to me, although I take credit for all these developments. As we did that, our efforts to expand this campus started to grow and grow at a much faster level. We found that companies and employers were less interested in incentive dollars and less interested in good financial deals than they were in being able to have easy access to talent and technologies that made them more competitive in their marketplace.
So it sounds like, you know, San Antonio was leveraging their existing strengths in human capital to sort of facilitate this transition.
Exactly right.
Well, I think that's certainly a good lesson. You know, we all should play to our strengths, I think. So I'm thinking back to the beginning of the program when you sort of mentioned that Port San Antonio being a private, what was the word you used again?
Private Air Force Base.
Private Air Force Base, yeah.
Yeah, and that's not a legal term of art. That's just a description.
Right, of course. We'll put that disclaimer on it. So how is Port San Antonio positioned between the public entities, you know, the federal government and private industry? And how do you see sort of your role in that partnership?
Well, our legal structure is really kind of interesting. We are legally very similar to a development company. So we build buildings, we own land, we develop property, we can invest in educational and programming activities. We have a lot of powers. But whereas most development companies have an ownership group that is an insurance company, real estate investment trust, or a bank, or a mutual fund, our ownership is public. And so we are legally a political subdivision of the state of Texas. Our board of directors is a publicly appointed board of directors. We have no taxing authority. The only revenues we get are the same revenues that any other business gets. But instead of plowing our profits back to our owners, we put our profits back into developing the campus and the systems around us. And what that does that's interesting is it becomes an interesting economic laboratory for a lot of the acquisition problems that are facing us. I'm going to start within the defense sector, within the military sector. We have a tremendous defense industrial base in this country, but it's a defense industrial base that has coalesced really from the Civil War through World War II. And then somewhat, I'm going to use a word I probably shouldn't use, but I say this with love, calcified. So it has become a very good, still the world's leading defense industrial base, but somewhat stagnant. And when we look out and we see what some other countries are able to do with speed of incorporation of new technologies, this becomes our next great national security challenge. The domain that we are going to start transitioning commerce through is a domain of the commercial sector. It's the internet, it's the wireless spectrum. And how can you provide national security in a commercial sphere that moves at commercial speed without having access to those new technologies? And so one of the things that our structure allows us to do is to be that connector. It allows us to be a bridge between the commercial sector, the academic sector, the entrepreneurial sector, the state and local government sector, and the federal sector. Not necessarily to bypass or avoid federal acquisition regulations or state acquisition regulations, but to provide an alternative path, an alternative circuitry that allows you to do that. Some of it is really, really simple. One of the challenges about our tremendously complex federal acquisition system is it is very difficult to go to market and see solutions if those solutions are not being crafted by one of the big systems integrators. On our campus, we've got a small museum. We're scaling it up with our new $63 million facility. But within that museum, you can see technologies that are being developed by the entrepreneurial folks, by academic folks, by research institutes. You can't necessarily buy out of it, but you can kick the tires on it. And as you kick the tires, what we found is a lot of times people see a solution to a problem set that they have. But because they're not familiar with that new technology, not in a million years could they write an RFP or an RFQ or an RFI to define that technology. And oftentimes, the person who's developing the innovation never in a million years would have thought about that application of the technology. It's a simple, you remember those old Reese's peanut butter cups commercials? You bring the chocolate and the peanut butter together. You not only create the environment for those creative collisions, but you actually create the place where those creative collisions can occur. And there's one, Colin, if you forgive me, I don't know if I'm making your job easier or harder. You ask, what's your name? And I spend 20 minutes telling you a story. There's one shiny example of that really excites me. It's this company called Reckon Point. And it was founded by a gentleman named Gabe Garza. Bumped into Gabe when he was working in the lab for another company. In his spare time, he had the idea of taking a LIDAR system and putting on the back of a small robot, because the challenge that he wanted to solve was people who owned commercial and industrial buildings that didn't have the blueprints anymore. And the traditional way that you go in there and measure it is you send an army of people in with tape measures and lasers. And they come back a couple of weeks later and tens of thousands of dollars later, having uploaded all those measurements into CAD. His system allows you to measure a space within a centimeter or two of accuracy almost instantaneously. So it got tremendous interest within the real estate sector. We were lucky enough to convince them to come set up an operation here on our campus and use our platform to meet other folks. And as he started to work with the folks in the aerospace sector, they saw applications to use that for everything from wayfinding to more efficient utilization of buildings. There's actually an opportunity to use that for lunar or remote manufacturing. Lunar caves, for example, there's a lot of interest in the lava tubes on the moon. But going up there with an astronaut is tremendously expensive and tremendously burdensome. If you can send this 40-pound robot up to the moon, and determine that that cave has the right type of floor, doesn't have holes in the ceiling, the right diameter, the right spaces, then you can do a lot of mapping at significantly less money with significantly less investment and significantly greater return. So long story short, doing nothing more than bringing Gabe to an environment where he can work right next door to people with PhDs and throughout industries. Lo and behold, Gabe finds himself being named one of eight companies in the world, one of eight startups in the world, changing aviation. And that's by Aviation Week. So tiny little company that not that long ago was the passion project of a guy working in somebody else's laboratory, being one of eight global startups recognized by Aviation Week, is exactly the type of encourage creative collisions that we found you can do with a campus like this.
And did you find that, you know, given the challenges of in-person interaction in the past year with COVID-19, were these creative collisions hampered at all, or how did Port San Antonio react to that?
They are. So we did the exact same thing that everybody did. A lot of activity went largely remote for the past year. And I will tell you that this is Jim's unsolicited opinion on it. I think it's really been a setback for Creative Solutions. There are some things you can do in a remote conversation and work tremendously well. There's a lot of things that you just can't do. And one of those things is truly have the ability to get a meeting of the minds and to find some opportunities. But ironically, it's led to a lot of thought about how we need to be able to address those communities that are remote, whether it's somebody on a spaceship or on a lunar or Martian environment, or somebody who's in an Arctic or Antarctic or very remote environment. And so we're really intrigued by a lot of applications that are going on with next generation telemedicine and taking it so that instead of just using the internet to do a consultation, an application of not just robotic intervention in a remote environment, but can you use additive printing technologies or cutting printing technologies to fashion medical devices, to fashion technologies that would be necessary for life, health, or safety? And so we're really tremendously excited about that. There's another little startup. I shouldn't call them a startup. They're a stage or two beyond startup, but Knight Aerospace, which has been doing modular interiors for years, has developed a modular medical pod, just sold their first device to the Royal Canadian Air Force. And what this allows you to do is transition virtually any cargo aircraft into a flying hospital room and then be able to take and offload that hospital room at a remote environment. You combine that with the ability to take robotic interventions, additive and cutting technologies worldwide, and then secure that information. And you've got yourself something that is tremendously exciting. Another application that we think is going to have really some groundbreaking opportunities as we move in the post-COVID world is the Plus One robotics system. And what these folks have done is they've taken industrial robots, which are really last century's technology, but they have been traditionally stuck in very controlled environments. They didn't have a lot of tolerance for anything new. And they've developed sensors and supervised autonomy, artificial intelligence, machine learning, networking, and cybersecurity capabilities. And now you have the ability to take the robot out of a controlled environment and put it into environments where it can augment manufacturing, resource allocation, or potentially even medicine. So it is tremendously exciting to see these capabilities come into place. Here at the port, yeah, I'd love to take credit for these folks, but they're the geniuses who are doing all this work. The only thing that we really do is we use our stage and our platform and our ability to intersect with government, private sector, academia, and institutes to connect those pieces, to connect those parts that may be a missing piece of the puzzle or maybe a cornerstone of the puzzle, to allow us to develop solutions that are going to be necessary for the next 100 years.
So, printed medical technology, lunar rovers, a lot of this technology, it sounds like science fiction, but it may be here very soon or already is here. So I want to move a little bit to space, the space industry. I know that's something that Port San Antonio is very excited about. In addition to some of the robotics applications that you've talked about, how do you see Port San Antonio fitting into the, you know, the burgeoning space industry?
Well, space is really the ultimate network problem. It's something where it's really, really difficult to reach out and physically maintain or physically touch something. It's very difficult to have that physical control. So the first challenge, and this is the way we've traditionally thought about space, has been the remote control of those systems, the communications between those systems. That becomes more and more of a challenge because it is very, very easy for those who know what they're doing to hack into those systems. So staying ahead of the communication security on those systems, vitally important. Next step is going to be, what are you trying to do in space? And if we're thinking about space correctly, it should be more than just having satellites up there for communications. Frankly, it should be more than just the projection of power on Earth. It needs to be, how are we going to access the resources that are off our planet, whether those are energy resources or physical resources or some combination. Getting there is going to require robotics. You know, we all love the idea of sending human beings off into space. We've all seen those movies. But it's expensive, it's difficult, it's burdensome, and it's probably unnecessary if what you're trying to do is go mine an asteroid, because that asteroid has the metals or minerals that are necessary to build our microprocessors or to provide those resources back on Earth. And that's where it's systems like Reckon Point, like Plus One Robotics, like Knight Aerospace, that becomes so vital to that. Nobody's going to turn around and say, Gabe, your Reckon Point system is the absolute system that we need to go do lunar manufacturing. But you can't do lunar manufacturing if you don't have the ability to go scout out a location for where you're going to manufacture it. Another program that we're tremendously excited about here at the port is run by the WEX Foundation. Sam Jimenez, working with NASA, and a bunch of students ranging from middle school through high school, they're building 3D printers that take a ground basaltic rock, because that's what moon rock is, and mix it with a biological compound to print a habitation. And they grind the rock using a lunar grinding machine. And that allows you to build the cap on top of that lunar cave. And the research is more than just academic. If you can figure out a way to do that, which means taking robots out of controlled environments, because there's no less controlled environment than the lunar surface or the Martian surface, then we start to have the pieces together that allow us to address it. But the thing that I really love about what the WEX Foundation is doing, in working with students, what they're doing is they're getting people thinking about solving these next generation problems. And this is as much a problem of the human psyche as anything else. We are hardwired to believe in scarcity. We're hardwired to believe that there are a finite number of resources. And economics will tell you there is scarcity, but we're nowhere near that scarcity limit yet. And if you can start to inspire people to think larger, to think about where those resources may come from that will provide greater economic opportunities, then we can stop thinking about automation as being something that is going to take jobs away from people and start thinking about something that is going to create more opportunities for people going forward. And that mind shift is so important, because whenever you have a technological jump, and we're at one of those geologic technological jumps right now, there is as much a societal pushback as there is a technological pushback. And so working with young people, working with students, getting people to view technology as something positive for the future is a vital part of what we, writ large as a society, need to be doing.
Have you, I suppose, in the local community of San Antonio, have you felt any sort of apprehension about this, even just the change itself as the port, you know, expands and deals with all of these very new things?
There's always, underneath the excitement, there's always a fear of the unknown. There's always a fear of the change. And the way we've been able to, I think, to manage that and turn it into a positive has been through this museum. So the San Antonio Museum of Science and Technology, which was the passion project of a guy named David Monroe, fascinating individual, invented the cell phone camera amongst a whole bunch of other things, has acquired this collection over the years of everything from Enigma machines to Tesla coils that play music to switchboards off of Air Force One, more computers than you know what to do with. And he started this little museum, and he wanted to bring people in and show them opportunities. Well, 3-4 years later, he's brought tens of thousands of young people and not so young people through that museum. match them up with educational programs, with opportunities. A couple of those startups I mentioned, we wouldn't have on this campus, but for the fact they came down, visit us through that museum, and that was our entree to us. They have started the SATX Robotics Meetup. It's 430 some odd people who gather once a month. During COVID, they did it virtually. They're starting to come back in real life with robots that do everything from fly to cut grass to just be your companion. And I think we're starting to get people, at least at a small scale, recognizing there are more opportunities here than there are obstacles for them. And I will tell you one thing that I think has become abundantly clear over this past year is that as we move into a world where people become part of the system, when you connect things up at a level, people are more than just part of the supply chain, because we've always been part of the supply chain. They are now part of the system. And the part that engineers haven't paid any attention to is the human factor. And look at the things we saw during COVID, the run on toilet paper. I'm sure there's a sociologist out there can explain it, but there's nobody with a supply chain degree out there that could explain it. Part of what is so exciting about what we're seeing starting to develop on this campus, and to be fair, at some other places in the country as well, is as you bring people in from different disciplines and you get them spending time with each other and actually talking with each other, the first reaction is always somewhat standoffish, somewhat, you don't have anything to teach me, you don't have anything that I can learn from you. But as time goes on and you build these meetups, as you build these collisions, you start to find solutions that actually do incorporate things that not only make the world better, frankly, get people working together. And so it's really exciting for us to see.
Are you looking to promote your brand to the government IT community? The Buzz with ACT-IAC is looking for sponsors. By sponsoring this podcast, you'll receive extensive visibility among government and industry decision makers, help drive continued conversation in the IT marketplace, and demonstrate your support for ACT-IAC's mission for a more effective and innovative government. We'll even give your ad the professional treatment, with music, sound effects, and a professional voice actor. That's me. For more information about sponsorship, contact Carol Miller at cmiller@actdiac.org or go to actdiac.org/sponsorship-opportunities. So we talked about this a little bit, but where does the port hope to go in the coming years or even 20 years down the line? What do you want the port to look like?
I want it to continue to grow the same way that it's growing right now, but with less direction coming from our port team as to what the future should look like. And more, there was a Texas Public Radio reporter who did a story on us and said this is somewhat punk rock in terms of where everything is. As we bring in more people from different disciplines and different walks of life to start solving these solutions, a lot of the groundbreaking technologies are going to come from people who are not necessarily part of the existing industry. And if we keep seeing that growth, you know, selfishly for our day job, we fundamentally get ranked on how many buildings we've built and how much square footage we've leased and everything else. We'll have no problem doing that if we've created a campus that is attractive to these solutions. If there are solutions that are developed on this campus that become part of the puzzle piece that allow us as a nation and as a society to truly master the space domain, and I don't mean just getting up there. I mean getting up there and use those resources so that we make life on Earth better, then we have succeeded. And that's going to be everything from ultimately space-based power generation, which is the ultimate green energy, and wireless power transmission, which is the ultimate resiliency, to distributed water systems, to robotic resource allocation. And if you can get to a point where anywhere on this planet, you can flip a switch and have working electricity and clean water, then what you have done is you have taken millions, hundreds of millions of people today who really don't have a chance to truly be economically participating, and you've brought them into that economic participation. Should be enough just to say from a human standpoint, we want to do that. But if you go and you bring those people into economic participation, then our ability to harness resources and to move us all forward economically will grow exponentially. And the proof of that, we spend a lot of time as a society, like I said, worrying about scarcity. But it's only scarce when you finally get to the point of resources that you can possibly harness. We haven't even scratched the surfaces of the resources that we can harness. And the economic output of the world today dwarfs the economic output of the world 100 years ago. And it will again 100 years from now. It's just a matter of how turbulent is the ride going to be between now and then.
So it's not just about innovative technologies. It's about innovative technologies that are accessible to everyone.
Absolutely. I mean, look back. One of the reasons I love that picture of Kelly Air Force being built so much is not just because you have airplanes and horses in the same room. Because I still think of myself as a Western cowboy. It's when those folks were building Kelly Air Force Base, we had had airplanes for 14 years. We had no idea what airplanes were going to ultimately be. But people were starting to come around to the idea that airplanes were going to be a major part of the world going forward. But if you lived in San Antonio or Dallas or Houston or many parts of this country in 1917, you may have still been using an outhouse. You may have still been riding a horse. We used stagecoaches until the late 1920s. We had steam passenger trains until the 1960s. I'm 50 years old right now, just turned 50. If I was born in 1910, I would have lived in a world that would have looked just like Red Dead Redemption 2. By the time I was my age, I could have hopped on a jet and flown nonstop to London. I could have flown trans-Pacific on a jet. We're going to have those same advances coming forward. But the solutions that brought us those advances were not just big government research project or big corporate research project. It was a lot of incorporating a lot of crazy ideas and finding ability to break into those solutions. And the part, and everybody tells me, Jim, you're in Texas, don't talk about this. Think about space-based power transmission and wireless power transmission. And what Freeman Dyson postulated with Dyson spheres, if we can get to that level where energy becomes truly free, truly efficient, truly a resource we can use anywhere on this planet, then we have overcome a bunch of hurdles. Just like Freeman Dyson said, you're going to move up that civilization scale. It's something that we're on the verge of being able to make happen. Within our museum, within the upcoming center, we're going to have this massive musical Tesla coil display, partially because it's the most metal thing you can possibly put into a music theater, but partially because people think this idea of wireless power transmission is crazy. Tesla was doing it in Colorado in the 1800s. You laughed when I mentioned Red Dead Redemption 2. You know, you meet Tesla under a different name in Red Dead Redemption 2. And he's got his big Tesla coil back out there. The challenge was not that we didn't know how to do it. The challenge was, how can we physically make that happen? How can we physically break down those technological barriers? When I look around our campus and I see 40-pound robots that can go measure lunar caves, I see the ability to take robots out of controlled environments and put them into uncontrolled environments, the ability to grind rock and 3D print a habitation, that allows you to access a lunar environment for manufacturing, to build satellites that we can't possibly build on Earth and launch, or at least build the buses and then go and manufacture those robotically while they're in orbit. Not telling you that's 5 years away, but just as 100 years from now, when I stand in that kitchen over there in that break room, and I look at the picture of them building Kelly Air Force Base. Those cowboys with the hats on had no idea that we were going to have supersonic jet fighters and spaceships and everything else. They just knew they were building something big. The people on this campus and the people that you talk to with your program, they're doing amazing things. We don't know what it's going to be like 100 years from now, but I hope somebody's looking at a picture of us 100 years from now and saying, yeah, they're crazy. They didn't know what they were doing, but without taking those steps, we wouldn't be where we are today.
So things like wireless power transition, Dyson spheres, you know, these are obviously amazing technology. They'd be civilization changing, as you said. What are some barriers that you see to mass adoption of these kinds of innovations that will radically change the way our economies are organized?
Well, you've got several. One, you've got the fact that we've got an economy that is largely based upon monetizing current distribution schemes and current ways of doing business. But that's been the case forever. We had the telegraph before we had the telephone. I remember as a young man, had a girlfriend, she lived on the other side of the country. I was spending a fortune on long distance bills. My kids have no idea what a long distance bill is. You know, they landlines are a thing of the past at this point. So industries come and go. Hudson Bay Company went from being a massive quasi-government company to running a couple of department stores in Canada. These things change. But it's always a societal change and a technological change. I think the larger change is how do we get to being able to acquire and incorporate these technologies? And again, you're not going to find a bigger cheerleader for the defense industrial base than Jim. But I will also tell you, somebody who's been in this industry for decades, we've got our own challenges. We've got a challenge of essentially doing the same solution over and over and over again, and not having our eyes open for a different way of looking for that answer. And it's just human nature. I'll tell you both a challenge that comes to mind and where I think there's an analogy of something that's successfully broken that. And the first one is, take this pandemic response. Every nation on earth has followed the science of epidemiology, which is a absolute science. I'm not by any stretch of the imagination bad-mouthing it. But every indicator that I saw on the news broadcasts for the past year and a half was a lagging indicator. You looked at positive test results, which were early on 2 weeks old and then a couple of days old as this went on. You looked at hospitalizations, emergency, intensive care, ventilators, and deaths, all of which are lagging indicators. They tell you where the disease was. They don't tell you where the disease is going. And then I look within the defense industrial world where we're doing things like the advanced battlefield management system, focusing on predictive analytics. And wouldn't it be fantastic if we could get those who understand medicine to work with those who understand the predictive technologies and the sensors technologies, the machine learning, the artificial intelligence, the data crunching, to be able to identify where the leading indicators are, to be able to figure out where the disease is going to go before the disease gets there. But you can't solve that problem if you don't have somebody in the room who understands the actual medical science and the biologic science, and somebody in the room who understands the actual future-looking science, the technology. Biggest problem there, for the most part, you go to a technology conference, all you see is technology people hanging out talking to each other. You go to an aviation conference, all you see is airplane people hanging out talking to each other. Never been to a medical conference, terrified of doctors, but I suspect it's nothing but a bunch of doctors hanging out talking to each other. And so part of the idea for this strategy that we follow here was a conversation with a friend at an airline, and they had spent a bunch of money on an app. They wanted to put on their phone the ability for their engine techs not to have to walk back and forth from the engine to the computer to get the drawings all the time. You look at that spaghetti chart, it's an awful lot of wasted time going back and forth. And they said, the problem is the app is wonderful. It never breaks. It looks fantastic, you know, keeps going despite every operating system update. The problem is whoever designed that app has no idea how a jet engine works and no idea what a jet engine tech needs. And part of what I hope we're proving with this model that we're building here at Port San Antonio, and to be fair, I'm not going to sit here and tell your listeners we're the only ones doing this anywhere in the country or the world, is bringing those people together who can look at problems from different perspectives. And as they do that, find new applications. I promised I'd tell you another example because I'm here. I like to tell a lot of stories about what's going on the campus. A company called Zyrek, a Dutch engineer, Peter Boink, absolutely brilliant man, came out of, I think he was with IBM. And somehow he realized that we've got a massive problem with how we strip coatings off of airplanes. The traditional way of doing that, I don't know if you've ever seen it, Colin, is you spray this chemical aqueous solution on the airplanes. And it's really cool to look at in a time lapse because it's this psychedelic mix of colors just sloughing off the airplane. But it is occupationally and environmentally tremendously dangerous. The facilities have to have all kinds of really expensive wastewater treatment facilities and personal protection. And so his idea was, if I build a robot with a laser, I can strip that coating, incinerate it, and render an inert, HEPA vacuum it right off. And in theory, I can save 500 gallons of toxic chemicals, 4,000 gallons of wastewater, 30 tons of carbon dioxide per aircraft, and save about 60% of the time that it takes just to strip that aircraft coating. He worked with some folks at Swery up the street, worked with us. We got him in contact with some folks who actually know airplanes and have airplane hangars. And lo and behold, on this campus, and you can see some of it online, there's a 72-foot tall robot with a 20-kilowatt laser attached to its arm that's undergoing those final qualifications to prove up that this is something that can work in industry. First, from the defense perspective, here's why I love this program. I've seen National Defense Authorization Acts that fund about two-thirds of the expected sustainment needs of our fleet in any given year. Doesn't mean we're not going to have those maintenance needs. It just means we're going to wind up with an awful lot of grounded airplanes, which means we have a very inefficient fleet, which means our ability to project strength is being adversely impacted. On the commercial side, I've seen an awful lot of work get offshored. I've seen an awful lot of work get deferred. If you can start to save those problems, it's not just a savings in terms of time and money and environmental and occupational health. It's your ability to be more efficient in how you utilize those systems. But to make this work, you know, it's easy to go look at Peter's robot right now. It's terrifying when you see it in operation, but it's easy to look at it and say, well, that's an easy idea. It's a lot harder to make that happen. If Peter didn't have the idea and didn't have the opportunity to work with people who understand lasers, who understand robotics, who understand airplanes, and frankly, have the ability to set up shop right next to a 2.5 mile long runway where you can run airplanes in and actually prove that this works.
So we're almost out of time, but I did want to ask one last question. Speaking of bringing people from lots of different perspectives together, I got some news blasts from Port San Antonio about a Super Smash Brothers esports tournament going on. For those who don't know, that's a fighting game. Esports, where did that come from?
It came from a couple reasons. So the first reason is I'm an outlier. I still love airplanes. I still love anything to do with them. But a lot of kids out there have no interest in any of this traditional aviation and defense work. They do have an interest in gaming. And so the first part was as simple as we want to find something that brings people in. But when you start looking at it, you see there is so much going on in the industry that has been gamified. And if you have some level of familiarity with computer gaming, you've got some familiarity with technology, it's a lot easier to move you over. And then we started noticing something even cooler about it. That's your best way to get people mixed up and matched up. I'm not even going to tell you about the artificial intelligence that underlies gaming, the predictive analytics, and everything else. You asked about one of the things we want to see on this campus. I've told the folks who are running our new center under construction, one of their key performance metrics within 2 years of that center opening, I want to host a wedding for some folks who met because of a gaming competition or a robotics competition or something else, and who wouldn't have bumped into each other but for that. What you find about gaming is it really is a universal language. It cuts across races, it cuts across socioeconomic barriers, it cuts across national barriers. And if you bring people together and they've got a common interest, whether it's Smash Brothers, I play Red Dead Redemption, but I'm old and boring, whether it's GTA, whatever it happens to be, and that becomes the ability to ignite some conversations, whether it leads to a personal relationship or a professional relationship or both, that's the way that you're going to drive economic success and social success. And so that's the reason we're doing this. Plus, I think it's going to be kind of cool watching all those gaming competitions. I think our facility right now is the largest purpose-built gaming arena in the country. So we're tremendously excited about it.
Well, as you said, you know, facilitating these creative collisions, you never know where the next great idea is going to come from. Thank you, Jim, so much for joining me. That was Jim Pershbach, President and CEO of Port San Antonio. Stay tuned here on The Buzz for more episodes in the future about Port San Antonio. They've got lots of projects that I'm sure they're very excited to talk about, and we're very excited to hear about. So once again, thank you, Jim. Any final thoughts?
No, thank you so much for having me. This has been a great time, and thank you for letting me babble on. Nobody at my house lets me do it.
And that's a wrap on The Buzz with ACT IAC. Join us next week for more hot topics and top issues affecting the federal technology market. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review on your favorite podcast platform, and follow us on Twitter at ACT IAC. More information about today's show can be found in the episode notes. For more insights, visit www.actiac.org. Thanks for listening.